up, just like, you know, like we're in the radio there, okay? We'll pretend, you know, this is the big time. I'll throw you hand cues and you can miss them. Just like the big time, all right? Yes, sir, Bob. Yeah, the big, wide, fantastic, unbelievable Walt Disney-type world. Somebody wrote me a note, says, Shepard, you know, have you noticed that all the new shows are comedies on television coming up? He says the greatest new one is a comedy about World War II German prison camps. He says, that'll be a laugh a minute. Yes, indeed. As Belson revisited with Soupy Sales playing the leading role. George Rooney. As a matter of fact, he says, you know, it looks like the whole world is getting to be either Walt Disney on one end, Soupy Sales on the other, with a little soup sound of perhaps Lenny Bruce in the middle. All serious thinkers on the larger issues of the day. Bring it up, hang on. I think that's enough of that mediocrity. Thank you. Speaking of mediocrity, have you noticed that I'm looking good these days? Have you fellas noticed that? Have you noticed how my eyes sparkle behind my impenetrable shades? You notice that, huh? Well, you know why this is. I'm thinking clean thoughts. I'm thinking beautiful, clean thoughts. And I have found that that does more for you. It does really more for you than anything else I know. I've tried push-ups. I've tried isometrics. I've tried reading Terry Southern. I've tried almost anything. I've gone to important movies. I've tried everything to pull myself out of the mire of mediocrity. I've done a lot of things, and I've discovered that, strangely enough, clean thoughts will do it. I've been revisiting the Bobbsey Twins. Great series of books. And, in fact, the other day I was sitting a chock full of nuts reading the Bobbsey Twins on the farm. It's a wonderful story. And there's a scene where, you know, they go out in the woods and they ride on this little wagon. Little goat pulls them in the cart. And they come home to Granny's house and she fixes them hot chocolate. One of the most exciting, dramatic things I've seen in a long time. I wonder why they don't do those. I think it'd make a heck of a movie. The Bobbsey Twins. Tony Perkins and Tuesday Weld could play it. Of course, you know, you've got to add a little pizzazz, you know, for modern day taste. It'll jazz it up a little bit, though. But I think Tony's been playing one of the Bobbsey Twins for years. Certainly Tuesday has. Or is it Wednesday? I forget. Of course, you know, time passes so quickly, you don't know what day it is anymore. So, all right, George, you know, speaking of time passing quickly, I'm fist-fighting my way through Midtown Manhattan this morning. And I caught a cab, you know, and it's about 2.5 hours later, we're still a block and a half from where I caught it. And the fantastic traffic and fist fights breaking out on all sides. And this squat figure, the cab driver ahead of me, said one of the great lines I've heard in a long time. You could see these giant buildings rising up on all sides of us. And the efficient looking. Have you ever, are you the type that sits in the back seat of a cab when you're finally truncated and you're not going to go anywhere? You know it, you know, for at least another hour. And you just sit there in the back and you watch chicks walking past you. I do that. I'm a great chick watcher from the backseat of cab. And somehow it gives you a sense of great importance because you're being driven through the city. You know, you feel like my chauffeur up here. I'll pause here for a moment. Do you mind if I drink a little champagne out of your slipper, honey? And she's on her way to her job in the mailroom at BBD. You know, it's just, well, I'm sitting back there watching the chicks and one thing and another. The horns are honking and the cab driver's getting the back of his neck is red, you know, and he's looking out. And all of a sudden, of course, the whole scene has to be recreated. It was far more than just the world of the taxis. It was more than the world of the 20th century excitement that we're part of. You know, this giant, fantastic, unimaginable traffic jam that is called the modern, hard-hitting, exciting life of New York City. It was more than that. Have you noticed that New York has become almost unbelievably, excruciatingly dirty. Oh, boy, what a dirty, rotten city. They don't talk much about that. You know, they all talk about the excitement of New York, and everybody talks about the pace of New York, which is, incidentally, a very slow crawl. For those of you outside of New York who think that New Yorkers live in fantastic speed, forget it. It took me at least an hour and a half to go six blocks. If that's a crawl, listen, I can crawl on one leg better than that in Waterville, Maine, with the wind against me and through snowdrifts. So there's no such thing as a fast pace in New York, believe me. They never say one thing, though. I think that's the most important part of New York, and that is the dirt of New York. I mean, you can stand on a street corner of New York for 7.5 minutes, and you can feel that stuff just falls in great waves, undulating waves. So nobody in New York, there isn't a single soul in the city who is not fully familiar with fallout of one kind or another. And some of the stuff, some of the fantastic exotic stuff comes out of the sky around here. And it just comes down in a long, steady, continuous rain. It just comes descending. You can stand a half an hour on a sidewalk in New York, and the drifts are up to your knees. And one kind or another. And they never talk about that side of New York. It's just never. Have you wondered why most of the citizens of New York wear shades? It's either that or no eyes. You do. You just have to wear shades, and it just bounces off you. So I'm sitting in this cab, and you can see the crud bouncing off the hood on all sides, you know. And the driver, he's been out, you know, he started out in the morning with a spanking, bright, shiny cab. You know, they washed it over the night. And by now, all he's got is a little slit that he's gouged out of the windshield, you know, with the crud. So he can see he's peering out, and the back windows are slowly crudding over. At the, you know, the thing about, perhaps you don't notice about New York cabs either, or New York streets in general, is that there's a continual liquid fallout on them from all kinds of things. Airedales, old guys sitting in doorways, all kinds of stuff. Just a continual uproar, boy, I'll tell you, stuff. And we're sitting in this cab, and the milieu has to be, you have to include the noise. I mean, up on top of his dashboard. On top of his dashboard, he had the little, they all carry it with him now. On top of his dashboard is his transistor radio. And New York is going all around us. There's continuous uproar. And we're looking out, you know. I can see the chicks going past me, and the crud and the fallout is coming down. It's constant uproar, you know. And the gears are shifting. And he's like, shut up, knock it off. He's yelling out there at the cop. And the cop is yelling back at him. His little transistor radio is playing on and on and on and on. John, I'm sitting in the back. I'm kind of lounging, and I'm reading the Post. I'm reading the back page of the Post. It says, Casey up and around, Mets drops. Seventh in a row. And, you know, life is going on in this big, rich city of ours, the fallout. New York Yankees claim they've been using frozen baseballs against them. That's why they happen to hit them, you know. You begin to believe that it's frozen kneecaps that are keeping the Yankees back, and I'm sitting there resting. And the transistor radio is going on and on and on. American culture is pouring in from all sides, everywhere you look, you know. And the uproar, and finally he reaches over, you know, the uproar outside is getting a little too loud. So he reaches up and he turns up his transistor radio.
Lady Falcon and Emily. And speaking of nuclear, here's this week's Speedy Clip Quip. Definition of a bachelor, a man who isn't married. The big KOS newsroom.
And he groaned.
Washington.
Radio was going on and on and on. It's the good guys. The four good guys are laying it out. The 10 of the 5 million good guys. They're squirting it out along with all the rest of the funny fallout of New York.
Don't break the devil and Frank Costello's mother.
Oh, wowie, what an exciting moment. Well, there was a brief instant there while it hung, and then all of a sudden he said it. He hadn't said anything for 7 blocks. That's like 2 hours. And he said, you know, and I looked at him, I said, what? He says, you know, my mother told me to go to school. My mother told me to go to school, and he turned it up again. He turned it up. What an exciting life. We sat there, both of us, mired in our own 20th century ignorance. I had gone to school, he hadn't, and both of us were caught in the same rotten, crummy, wild, swinging, noisy, fallout, dirty, stinky trap on 47th Street, heading against the fantastic tide of 20th century America. My mother told me to go to school. Well, my mother told me to go to school. I did. He didn't. And there we sat, separated by a foot and a half of dirty, rotten cab, going the same way.
This week's Speedy
Clip Quip.
Definition of a bachelor, a man.
Oh, on and on and on it went. Now, you know, I thought about that after we headed on down. I finally arrived here at this rat's nest, and the uproar continued here. The 4,500 elevators going up and down, and 18,000 little short guys with gray fedoras, with with the brown attaché cases getting off and on, and their cigars going fiendishly in the oven, you know. And I was thinking about that line, and that line, you know, all this jazz that they're putting on the air about dropouts, all this crud, you know, they come out with 45 minutes of rock and roll, and they think this is going to convince, Murray the K, one of our deeper thinkers, this is going to convince the klutzes sitting out there, they ought to go back to school. Well, Murray shows it, you know. And I'm wondering, and I'm not saying anything about whether or not. See, I think people confuse entertainment with communication. And the idea that you've entertained 4,000 kids who are dropping out with rock and roll, the idea that you've communicated the idea that they shouldn't drop out, is a totally erroneous one. In fact, I have seen hours of entertainment put on in the name of good works. I have been myself, I've been on at least a half dozen telethons. I have made it a rule for the last couple of years to never even get near those monstrosities. And they're done with the idea that they're doing something for good works. Well, you know, this letter this kid wrote to me that I mentioned here earlier on the opening of the show is very true. It's literally true that today entertainment has totally superseded any kind of serious consideration of any problem that we're faced with. And so we take the case, let's say the case of one of the passé subjects of our world, the atom bomb. People really think they've done something about the atom bomb when they go to see a Stanley Kubrick movie. They really do. They honestly do. They have that great sense of being right thinkers, you know. They walk down the street, they paid their $4 to see this turkey, and they feel that they've really done a majestic thing about the atom bomb. Large numbers of people, seriously, will read a book by James Baldwin and think they've done something about civil rights. Now this is a difficult problem, because our world is full of right-thinking people who prefer to think about subjects or talk about subjects or breastbeat about subjects or wail about subjects, and then they put in their little wailing period and then they go off to business as usual. Now, this is not necessarily new, but it's getting to be a major difficulty in our time. Always there were the non-doers. They always were with us. But today, the non-doer has begun to believe he is a doer. That's a new trick. That's a new twist to it. In short, the guy who buys a Lenny Bruce record really thinks he's done something for freedom of speech, you know? This is a fascinating problem. 1,800 kids sitting in a teach-in. Now, again, with the parallel that has developed too, the parallel of entertainment as an action, a positive action. The idea of sitting in an audience at an entertainment, this is felt today to be a positive forward movement. You know, one of the things that I have felt very strongly about so many of the civil rights units that I have been off and on involved with is that they all seem to eventually wind up as entertainment. They're sort of like a traveling USO troupe. And so they're constantly having these various things where Duke Ellington and where Marion McKeeba, where any one of five, Bob Dylan sings, so, you know, the whole scene, everyone sits and applauds and roars and pays their $2 and leaves. And this is being really a brave civil rights fighter. This is a problem which, and on the other hand, have you noticed that civil rights has been often largely taken over by entertainment figures, who merely do what they've always done. They tap dance, they sing, they get up on the platform, and hardly anybody ever listens to people, sociologists, for example, people who have made a genuine study of this issue. Nobody's bothering with that, because it's not entertaining. It ain't fun. It is not fun to listen to somebody who has studied the economic, the socio, the educational problems involved in such things as civil rights. This is a drag, and so nobody bothers with it. There are countless discussion shows going on the air, ranging all the way from the David Susskind big-time TV discussion show to the serious afternoon programs on Sunday. Who are they constantly talking to in these civil rights programs? Oh, people like Harry Belafonte. This is a deep thinker. People like Dick Gregory. You know, I like Dick Gregory, but he is not necessarily Bertrand Russell, you know. People like, and I'm putting these people down. They will get Steve Allen. I like Steve Allen, but Steve Allen often, Steve Allen is, he often reminds me of my emotional Aunt Teresa, who was always emotional about the right things, but totally illogical. 97% of the time, and would reduce herself often to just a state of going, when you finally get her down to, well, now, come on, let's talk about the real situation. Speaking of the emotional, this is WORAM and FM in New York. And this you know, I don't often talk about these things on the air, but because I am in the entertainment world. And I recognize, though, that most people get very irritated when they begin to hear serious discussions of one thing or another about subjects which can be very, very troublesome, unless they're larded with laughs, unless they're watching a star do it, unless, you know, who wants to hear about the problems of Birmingham if you're going to talk to two sociologists and a social worker and somebody who really knows something about it, when you could get somebody, say, really jazzy like a Norman Mailer. So ultimately, we wind up confusing entertainment with action, which can be a very serious problem. And so you'll find that in most colleges today, many colleges today, they would much rather hear Joan Baez discuss Vietnam than, let's say, the ambassador to Vietnam, who has come back after 2 years of studying the subject and working with them, much rather hear what Bob Dylan has to say on the subject. They would much rather hear a professor at their university, who is a beloved figure anyway, who is teaching romance literature of the 12th century. They would much rather hear him talk about Vietnam than, let's say, somebody who has to deal with it every day across the table and who knows perhaps a little more about it than he does. Why? It's all part of that entertainment syndrome. They would much rather hear seven freshmen from Dental Polytech who have learned to sing "I've Been Working on a Railroad" through their noses. They would much rather prefer to hear pseudo-folknik folk singers sing about poverty than somebody who has spent the last year and a half in West Virginia and studied the subject and can say something about it and tell them about it. They'd rather hear Bob Dylan sing, "Oh, you don't know what troubles I see now walking on the long road of life." Oh, come on. You really think you're finding out about the poverty listening to big friendly Jack Elliott, who spends all of his time in the Fiend John? You really do? You really think you know something about the Irish by listening to the Clancy Brothers? Get it off. Come on. And seriously, though, this is a real problem, even though everybody's probably laughing now when I'm saying this is a genuine problem today. That we have a country right now that has the greatest amount of communication facilities that's ever been developed in any major power in the world. And here we sit with all these things. We sit with all these radios. And what do we have hour after hour on every radio station in the country, with very, very few exceptions? Hour after hour. Well, you get it set up then. Hour after hour after hour. What do we have when it comes to serious discussion, you know? I'll tell you what it is. I think that the Americans basically are probably the quickest bored people in the world. I think at the very background of it is we have probably the lowest boredom threshold of any people in any country anywhere. That means that boredom sets in quicker with us than it does with most other peoples. Perhaps because America is a country of extroverts. America is a country of bowlers. America is a country of playgoers. America is a country of Mary Martin fans. It's a country, by the way, it's also a country of demonstrating fans, because that is not boring either, you know. So don't just think I'm putting down Mary Martin fans, that everything has to be put in the form of a play, or we're not interested in it. Every drama, every problem has to be put in the form of a bad novel, like Fail Safe. Everything has to be put in the form of two-bit genuinely, I wish I could use some of the words that I could really use about this kind of stuff. Ill-informed, turned out to sell melodramatic pulp literature that masquerades as the, you know, dealing with the problem. This kind of pulp, you know, it's just like taking the good guys and the bad guys. It's like taking the robbers and the cops and putting them into communist capitalist. I've read a half a dozen of these novels, and I wonder how many people actually take them seriously. Things like The Ugly American. This is pure childish balderdash. I've read it, and I know what I'm talking about, and I've been to those parts of the country, the parts of the world that that this deals with. It's as childish as the Western. The Western pulp fiction is... do you really believe Western pulp fiction is about Dodge City? You really do? You really think this is the real way it was? Do you really think Shane really is about the West? I mean, seriously? Do you think High Noon is the way it was in Texarkana? You really do? Well, if you do, then you're really ripe for the kind of thing which passes today for grappling with a situation that is a worldwide, or certainly maybe in most cases a countrywide problem. We are so attuned to entertainment that we often confuse entertainment with thinking. We often confuse entertainment with reality. And so if we see a play, I saw a play recently on Broadway about the civil rights issue. It was one of the silliest, saddest, worst-written pieces of pulp claptrap I have seen in my life. It made Uncle Tom's Cabin look like a genuine sociological treatise. It really did. And because it was written by a beloved writer of our time on the subject, it was hardly anyone dared to say it. Very few of the critics dared to open their mouths and say, this is really bad playwriting. It's not only bad playwriting, but the ideas are ridiculous in it. And I am not, again, I guess one of the fears is that once you begin to say certain entertainments which have pseudo-high-mindedness, pseudo-serious entertainments, once you say something against them, it is construed by the public at large that you are against the good themes that they're for, or ostensibly for. That's why so many critics, you know, are very much afraid to blast the fantastically bad biblical epics which continue to come out of Hollywood continually. They come out of Hollywood almost every couple of months. There's always a giant thing starring Charlton Heston with his face painted orange, you know, and he's wearing a bearskin rug. And behind him, you have music by Dmitri Tiomkin, pseudo-religious music. And he's coming down out of a cardboard mountain, you know. And it's such bad stuff that it makes you embarrassed to even look at it. And yet you'll find very few critics will really say that, because they're afraid that if they say this is a bad movie, they will sound like they're atheistic. They will sound like they're anti-Bible or anti-Christian or whatever it might be. Now, this holds true in many other forms of entertainments today. We go seriously. I've often thought, have you noticed in book review sections, for example, they will categorize literature. They will say serious literature. That's all up in the front of the New York Times book review section. Then they will have Western, and they'll have a whole page of Westerns. Then they'll have a whole page of detective fictions. They call it crime at large, whatever that might be called. Have you noticed they categorize fiction like that? And that, in a sense, gives them a chance to blast what they want to blast for the fact that this is just a detective story, so they throw it into that bin. This is just a Western story, they throw it into that bin. This is serious because it's thick, and Saul Bellow wrote it, so it's serious. They throw it into that bin. And I've wondered why they don't really come out with some honest categorizations of these things. Why don't they have a categorization, homosexual literature, just as cleanly and definitively defined as, say, Western literature? Because this form of literature has its own shadowy, it has its own stock figures. And it's as serious, by the way, as most Western writing is. Has it ever occurred to you that many guys who write what we call Western pap are serious about it? I've known a few of them. I've known guys who've written... You know that Raymond Chandler was very unhappy that he was never accepted as a serious writer. He thought his books were very serious. They kept putting it in the back there where it says detective literature. He was dealing with crime, you see, as his raison d'etre and his good and evil. Today, in this age of sex writing, the only serious book is a book that deals with sex. That's literally what we've come to believe in, and that's it even crops out in little side comments by people like Richard Watts the other day. And I happen to like a lot of things Watts says, but the other day he was saying he was looking at a play in England, and in passing he remarked, he says, of course, he says, this is going to be a kind of a controversial play. It deals with ordinary sex as opposed to the traditional themes of adultery and so on, which means in a sense that the theme of all serious writing in our day is sex. And so that's a fascinating development. Now, on the other hand, whenever anybody deals with so-called serious situations, genuine situations like let's say the war in Vietnam. Let's say the war, the big conflict of our time between capitalism and communism. It has to be dealt with in the form of these fantastically, unbelievably bad novels by people like the late Eugene Burdick. People who turn these things out in about 7.5 minutes flat, written from headlines and taken from very bad reports by second-rate reporters everywhere. This is the way a serious subject is dealt with. I submit to you that, in general, most books written on sex are not serious at all. They're fantasies. I submit that to you for what it's worth. We all live in a world. We've all had our experience with sex, one kind or another. Does it have any relationship at all with the stuff that you generally read about it in most novels? Of course not. That's part of that fantasy world. And so I submit to you, for whatever it's good, and by the way, that's a pompous word to use, submit. I submit to you that this is the true fantasy world. In other words, fantasy fiction is really most of what we call serious literature. To me, that is true fantasy fiction. Something like Norman Mailer's American Dream is fantasy fiction. Whereas, on the other hand, I think most of what is written in the world of fantasy fiction, what we call ordinarily fantasy fiction, is not fantasy fiction at all. These are the guys that are really seriously thinking about the problems that face the world. Automation, the space problem, the future of mankind. These are little problems, so they go way in the back by the crossword puzzle and the ads for trusses. The reviews, if they're reviewed at all. And up in the front, some piece of total claptrap, like the American Dream, is treated seriously. This is genuine fantasy fiction. Most of what is written on the civil rights is fantasy fiction. This is a very personal comment here, and I'm not attempting to foist my attitudes of these things off on anyone else except here I am. I'm airing them. That's all. But I will say that I feel very, very strongly about the slow encroachment of entertainment into the world of what could have been a serious dialogue about the. You know, I think one of the reasons why many people don't like Johnson, he's not very entertaining. Johnson is just not a pizzazzy TV personality. He just isn't. And in fact, I was reading one of the so-called top critics of the administration recently, and he seemed to hold that against Johnson more than anything else, was the fact that Johnson wasn't exciting. And he held that down. Well, Hitler was very exciting, for those of you who are interested in real going personalities. He really was. Be careful when we begin to confuse exciting personalities with deep thinking. This is quite often the case today. And, you know, are you aware that most serious, and I use that in quotes, discussion programs on television today very carefully screen anybody who is going to be on the discussion, and they're supposedly having a serious discussion, to make sure he's what they call, in their jargon, by the way, be careful because this is a loaded word. Well, Manny, is he articulate? What they mean is he jazzy? Does he come on strong? They don't necessarily mean articulate at all. They mean, is he photographic? Is he interesting? Does he have a clever turn of phrase? Does he realize we're in showbiz? You know, keep the show moving. Let's come up with the jazzy little remarks. Let's talk about the, you know, the big end things. I'll never forget the time I was really thrown by this. The first time I began to see it in action, I was in the control room when a famous late senator was being interviewed. A show which is no longer on the air, a network show. And it was a show where every week they took a controversial character and he got on the air and he was interviewed by this top newsman. And so halfway, it was about 9/10 of the way through the show, this guy all of a sudden accused, he took one look up at the clock and he realized they only had a minute and a half or 30 seconds left on the air, and he accused the interviewer of being a well-known communist sympathizer. He said, "Everyone knows that you're a communist sympathizer. Everyone knows that you're a comm simp. And I believe that the kind of people you represent, whether consciously or not..." Well, he laid it out. I mean, that's pretty interesting to accuse the interviewer of being a communist, in a sense. Well, there was just a brief second, and he went off the air. He timed it, see? And he rushed out of the control room and says, "How did you like that communist bit at the end? That'll give him something." He said, "Boy, that's exciting, isn't it?" And the guy stood there with his mouth hanging open. In other words, it was done as a showbiz gambit because it was exciting. It was exciting, and he recognized it was exciting. And tomorrow morning, they would be quoting him in the news. And the next day after that, he'd be interviewed about it, and the excitement would continue. Now, when that kind of let's be entertaining attitude begins to creep into the actual makers and the formers, the shapers of history, then look out. But I do feel, though, that today in this world of television and radio and best-selling novels, this world of instant people, this world of instant success, this world, you know, that are you aware that today in most art galleries and in many big art circles, that an artist, forget it, is not going to make it unless he is an interesting personality himself. If he's good copy, if Vogue magazine thinks his hair is cute, if Vogue magazine likes the kind of pad he lives in, then he stands a good chance of going all the way. That's the show business. Now, that's harmless. To me, I think it's silly, it's sad, but it is harmless. I don't care whether Vogue loves Andy Warhol far more than it loves his work, which is largely banal. I don't care. That's all right, because he'll be forgotten in a couple of months. This is the way of that kind of thing. But when we begin to bring that sort of attitude into other areas, then we're really in trouble. Then we really have got to be very careful. We've got to be very careful. Incidentally, that's another thing, too. This precludes, eventually, actually learning about any of the subjects at hand. Because I have found that most people who are wildly entertaining, who make good copy, rarely are people who spend much time attempting to get at the facts. Why? Because it's a different kind of personality, that's all. It's just a different kind of man. It's just a different kind of, and I don't want to make a generality like that. I'm not saying that people who know what they're talking about are always non-entertaining. I don't want it to be construed as that. However, it is a fact that in real life, quite often, the best people who do what they do best are often drab and colorless. The best lawyers I've ever known are guys who just believe me. They're not like the movie version of Clarence Darrow. They're superb lawyers, however. They really know what they're doing, and they really get it done. This is true in almost all serious fields. Very few good doctors look at all, act at all, or think like Ben Casey. Very, very few. And I want to give you one word of advice. If you run into a doctor who does, be careful. Be very careful. If you run into a lawyer who sits back and snaps his suspenders, and who spits into the spittoon and opens up his celluloid collar and says, "Well, let's see, son, as old Phineas Pinkham used to say, be careful." You could very well be dealing with Phineas T. Flywheel. You could very well be dealing with the character that W.C. Fields always played as a lawyer. Now, on the other hand, this is true of politicians. You notice that today everybody's very excited about a politician here in New York City because he's cute. Now, I happen to know the man, and I admire him, but I'm not necessarily going to go along with the general attitude that because he's photogenic and he's got a great personality and knows all the right things, knows all the discotheques to go to, knows all the right dances to dance, that he is necessarily one who can deal really with some of the serious problems that face New York City. I wonder whether anybody can, but I'm not so sure that a man is necessarily qualified because he's entertaining, because he makes good copy, he's exciting, he's photogenic. These are all things which have come to become very, very important in our time, far more important today in our time than at any given time in history. Another thing, too, is as part of our showbiz syndrome, this is part of it. You notice that no showbiz attempt to talk about real life ever deals with anybody over 30 years old, ever. No chick who's in love with a guy is ever over whatever that nominal Brigitte Bardot mythical age is. Never. If she is, that's called a character bit, and it's played by Patricia Neal. However, real life seems to consist of young people doing things today, because this is part of the showbiz syndrome. And so real love is only able to be consummated, and sex and all this is always has to be by somebody under 30. This is a fact. All good thinkers are under 30, unless it's a father figure, and he just sits in the background and rocks. That's Spencer Tracy. He's always the old judge. That's something else again. But however, this is one of the reasons why we suspect today any man who shows up on the TV screen, and he doesn't seem to be young enough. He doesn't seem to be young enough to be smart. He doesn't seem to be young enough to have wisdom. And I think this is one of the reasons why Mr. Johnson is in trouble, because Johnson does appear to be a mature man. He appears to be a man who has been around, has thought a lot of things, and has seen a lot of things and experienced a lot of things. And this can often be a drug on the mind. And by the way, I'm not here giving a speech pro Johnson. I am merely saying, though, that some of these things are some of the reasons why Johnson is not necessarily. And oh, incidentally, that's another thing. The weak man today is often called he's called the truthful man. That a man today who is weak and who is frightened and who is unsure of himself is the man that many weak, unfrightened, unsure people will trust. And this is one of the reasons why almost all of our comics in the past 3 or 4 years have been little, weak, scared guys. It's the Woody Allen syndrome. They somehow are truthful. If a guy walks out and he's 6'2", and he's bronzed, and he has a square jaw, and he says, "Man, you don't know what trouble is." Nobody believes him. Why? Well, we go that way. And one of the things that we hold secretly, subconsciously against Johnson is he ain't Holden Caulfield. He has ideas, and he believes in them, and that's the end of it, you know. And he'll stand up for them, and obviously, in spite of all kinds of adverse criticism, he will do it. And that's bad scene in a world where today most people wear rimless glasses and talk about how they're victims of society. He is not a victim. And so I suspect that the next big presidential candidate will be a victim, or he will proclaim himself a victim. He will play victim. And he will be little, he will be scrawny, he will be cute, lovable. He will be the kind that everybody wants to help and move on, everyone. And we want to say, well, you know, he couldn't be telling us evil things because, after all, he's one of us. And this is part of the showbiz syndrome and that it is all around us. You know, this is one of the reasons why large numbers of people in Germany dug Hitler. Because Hitler was a little scrawny guy, and he seemed to be just a little man that everybody, you know, he's just a little corporal. You know, and after all, he's speaking for us. He's a little man. He's known the terrible problems that we've all had, you know. And so there was an empathy there. But I'm wondering, after looking at so much of this jazz that goes on, I must get invited to at least 9 different things every week. And what do they want you to do? Do they want you to come to these things and talk seriously about civil rights? No, they want you to come and entertain about civil rights. I'm always invited by student groups to come and talk about, entertain about Vietnam. That's what they want. They want a couple of big, wildly funny put-down lines, you know. This is what everybody wants. Nobody really wants to hear that it ain't so easy. Nobody really wants to hear what Mao Zedong said last week. You don't hear much talk about that. And if you do, somebody says, oh, this is a right-wing rabble-rouser. What's he bringing in here? Extraneous stuff? Well, is it extraneous? I don't know, you know. I'm not so sure. Nobody wants to see pictures of what the Viet Cong are doing to little children in the Vietnam jungles. Nobody wants to see those pictures because somehow they give you that vague, uncertain feeling that maybe there are two sides to this problem, which then precludes entertainment. I'm curious, you know, going back to the original premise, have you noticed how many dramas we have today on the air that use war as a basic spine? McHale's Navy, Broadside, all these. And have you noticed that almost all of them are funny? Almost every last one of them is funny. They've made war into some kind of a big, wild, funny entertainment thing where Ernest Borgnine rides around on a PT boat and yells and hollers, and they spend all of their time chasing waves, you know? Is it really that way? Do people really care whether it's that way or not? Well, I don't know, you know? You know, it's funny. Every time on any given show, I'm talking about my own personal thing here. On any given show, when I am doing shows, when I come on and I strive to be funny, I get large numbers of letters. You know, this is a fantastic show. But whenever you do a show where you seriously talk about things that are bothering you, you'll get dozens of letters saying, what is this lecture? Come on. Well, when are you going to tell about when you were a kid, you know? Come on, get back. Tell us a wonderful story when you were in the Army, you know, and so forth. And you know, it's interesting. Whenever I tell an Army story that really deals with the war, people get very bothered and write angry letters. And yet they want me to tell Army stories. Like the time I told the Army story of riding back in the train. Riding back in the train, sleeping on the coffin of a dead PFC. This bothered a lot of people. And why? Well, you know, war is war, you know. And really it is what Sherman said it was. Ripped torn in combat to the contrary. McHale to the contrary. War really is that. And maybe we've created our own. Maybe we all secretly want it. Maybe man wants and desires and hungers after hell as much as he hungers after heaven. And since it's easier to produce hell, he whips it out whenever the hunger gets a little too strong. I suspect there may be something to that. But then again, this makes the whole problem very complicated. It can't be dealt with in a 3-line bit by Lenny Bruce. It can't be disposed of in one single fantastic, insightful comment by Mort Saul. Right, gang? How about let's all singing a folk single about it, huh? Who wants to play the guitar? I'll sing tenor.